Okay, lecture number, we're running late again. Lecture number 3 on Old Testament survey. We're just giving a brief overview of Old Testament introduction. We refuted the documentary hypothesis in the last lecture. Now what we need to do is provide positive evidence for the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch. Now to provide evidence for the Mosaic authorship, one of the things we're going to need to argue not only is that Moses wrote it, but we're going to have to put these writings back during the time that Moses wrote it, which was about 1450 to 1410 B.C., was when Moses would have wrote this stuff. Okay, I'm going to just list some evidences. You can jot them down as I go along here. The unity of the first 5 books. Now, if somebody holds a documentary hypothesis in its current forms, if they try to say there is no unity, well, then why did they invent this hypothetical editor? The fact that they invented the hypothetical editor means they know that there's some overriding unity throughout the first 5 books of the Bible. Another evidence is that the Pentateuch, the first 5 books of the Bible, the rest of the Old Testament and the New Testaments, Jesus himself, all of these are different witnesses, different books written at different times that call Moses the author. We don't have time to list it. If I listed all the times the Bible said that Moses was the author, just when you get time, look at our concordance, an unabridged concordance, one of those big concordances, look up Moses, and then find how many verses just mention Moses as saying something that was written by Moses years before. I'll just give you a few of the books there. Joshua chapter 8 verse 31 says Moses wrote the first 5 books. 1 Kings chapter 2 verse 3 talks about the law of Moses, the law was written by Moses. Daniel 9:11. Jesus in Mark chapter 12 verse 26 talks about the Moses writing the law. Mark 12:26 and Luke 20:28. And Romans 10:5. We don't have time to turn there and look at these passages, but some of these passages are pretty incredible when you look them over and you see they're coming right from the lips of our Lord, Moses writing this and writing that, and you find, well, that quote is from Deuteronomy, and he said Moses said that, so Moses wrote Deuteronomy, and this quote's from Exodus, so Moses must have wrote that, and this quote is from there, and you find that what was traditionally passed on down by the Jews, Jesus believed. So the question comes up, could Jesus be mistaken? Well, if you're liberal, yes. If you really believe that Jesus is God, then your answer is no. The eyewitness details in the Pentateuch. Many eyewitness details. You know, even the way the laws were set up was for a people, a nomadic people. There were laws set up for people who were traveling through the desert. For instance, give me all the verses in the first 5 books of the Bible that talk about prison terms. How much time in prison you should put people in. Yeah. Well, you don't have, like, you know, you either the crime was bad enough to put the guy to death, or the crime wasn't bad enough to put him to death and you make him pay restitution, or you kick him out of the camp, but you're not going to be able to have a prison if you're trapped wandering through the wilderness. Yet the times that the liberals say that these things were supposedly written between 850 and 500 B.C., the Jews were living stationary lives at that time. They weren't traveling all around and did not need a legal system for a nomadic lifestyle. But there were many eyewitness details of the first 5 books of Egypt that are given, of the wilderness area are given, but very few details of Palestine. Why? Because Moses was never there. But he was in the other places. He grew up in Egypt. He wandered through the wilderness. but he never made it to the promised land, at least until the transfiguration, Matthew 17, he and Elijah at the side of Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. Also, the author is, as I mentioned already, really, the author is acquainted with Egypt, but unfamiliar with Canaan. Well, if it was written as late as the other guy said, these people, the authors, probably these pseudo-authors that these other guys come up with would probably never been to Egypt, but were very familiar with the land of Canaan, with the land of Palestine. As I mentioned already earlier, too, there's the desert atmosphere and point of view, even to the punishments of criminals. There are second millennium B.C. customs. So customs that can be traced back to 2000 B.C. that we know about now that we might not have known about in the time of... that these guys started coming up with their views and the documentary hypothesis. Even the household idols and stuff like that, that you find some of the people having in the book of Genesis, talk of those second millennium B.C. customs. There's also a greater percentage of Egyptian words are in the first five books of the Bible than the rest of the Bible. Now, you might say, well, I thought the Bible was written in Hebrew. Yeah, it was written in Hebrew. I speak English, but at times you'll hear me use foreign words. Not just when I'm quoting from Greek or something, but when I say, piano. That's an Italian word. It's an Italian word for a musical instrument. It's not an English word. We just took it into the English language, but it's an Italian word. And you find that many times. Daniel's writings, we're going to see that he had Greek words of Greek musical instruments in his writings. So there's a greater percentage of Egyptian words in the first five books than the rest of the Bible. You would expect that to be the author to have some real good knowledge of Egypt. And lo and behold, Moses was raised in Egypt. Also, Moses is qualified to be the author. He was well-educated. He had a significant knowledge of Egypt and the Sinai Peninsula, the wilderness of Sinai. Acts 7:22 also talks about him being educated in Egypt, which is kind of a given. If you're going to be raised in the Pharaoh's household, you're going to get a good education whether you like it or not.
Who said that?
It was Stephen said everything in his speech. Somebody's going to put you to death. You're going to preach the longest sermon you can possibly do.
Could there be an argument made for the fact that you would try to use, you would say Moses is qualified to be the author because of what it says in the first five books? Couldn't they make an argument saying, well, you're just trying to, but that doesn't make
they could, but again, what we have on our side, even here, we're not using the Bible as, number one, obviously, the Word of God. We're using it as historically reliable, which is something that they wouldn't accept. But the way that they, if they find a historical document, it is considered true unless kind of true till proven false, rather than innocent till proven guilty, that same type of thinking. And that's the way they treat all ancient documents except when they get to the Bible. And so I think we can make a real good case that the author does not fit the characteristics of anybody that they put forward in the time frames they put forward. But if you just take the traditional Moses, even if you don't even consider him a true human being, you take the traditional Moses and look at everything that was said about him, that this is consistent. This book was written like it was written by that type of person. And that argues that an educated man with a tremendous knowledge of Egypt and the Sinai Peninsula. Different divine names are often used in different contexts. For instance, Elohim seems to be the title of God when dealing with God as creator and dealing with God's power. Elohim. Jehovah seems to be used when God, in regards to his covenant relationship with his people, God making an agreement with his people and having a personal relationship with his people. These guys weren't apes. They were very intelligent human beings to make our scholars today look like idiots. If you're hung up on evolution and you really think man is evolving, getting better and better, go to Monticello over there in Virginia. But go to Monticello over there, and 200 years ago, Thomas Jefferson lived there. And look just walk around his place, his library, 20,000 volumes. He read in 7 different languages. He hooked up, made a little machine so that every letter he ever wrote in his exact handwriting, he was getting an exact duplicate made simultaneously, just about 18 inches away from him. And he was not classified as a genius. He used to look up to Ben Franklin as a genius. He was just a very intelligent, well-educated man. But he makes our geniuses today look like idiots. And I think it can be documented. When you look at today's theologians, and then you compare their writings with Thomas Aquinas in the 1200s, it's like night and day. Anyway, the variation in diction and style, the variation in the terms they used, the words they used, their grammar, their style, that could be explained, number one, by different types of literature. For instance, show me one author who writes genealogies with the same exact style that he would write a biography. You know, genealogy is the list of this father begat this guy, who begat that guy. Show me somebody who writes genealogies and biographies, the life story of one particular person, and historical accounts, which may cover centuries. Show me somebody who with those different types of literature would not vary his diction or his style. You know, you're obviously going to have to use a different style to cover different types of things like that. Also, the author varied his text to prevent monotony. Why do we have to assume that these guys that are right, Joe threw the ball? Lenny caught it. Lenny threw the ball back. You know, he's going to vary it. He's going to vary it like a good author would. I've never been able to check it out, but they said that some guy had some computer studies that the writings of Paul was no liberal. Liberal scholars admit that Paul wrote most of the letters that Paul supposedly wrote today. But some guy supposedly did some computer analysis, was supposedly proved that 4 different authors wrote one of Paul's letters. And so a computer expert who was a Christian took that guy's article and fed that information through his computer. His computer said 3 or 4 different guys wrote that article. One of the problems is computers don't have human personality. They can't be up and down. You know, when I'm in a good mood, I appear to be a different guy than when I'm in a bad mood. Yeah.
Did you see about Thomas Jefferson and how he was centered in the wheel? I read a book about 1970, was written by a theologian who was writing about the city of Europe. He said we've actually gone backwards as humans since that time.
Yeah.
Our knowledge.
Yeah. That's for sure. And it's we think that we're smarter because we know more. But in actuality we know more because, as the old saying goes, we are dwarfs who stand on the shoulders of giants. So we can see further than them. But they did most of the thinking. Most of the thinking was done by the Wright brothers and Goddard that eventually got us to the moon. I mean, first we had to figure out how to get a heavier-than-air thing to stay in the sky for a while. That was the Wright brothers. Then we had to get some rocket technology that came with Goddard and some German scientists as well. But we're just dwarfs standing on the shoulders of giants, so we can see further, but it doesn't make us taller than them. So the author varied his text to prevent monotony, and then parallel accounts were a poetic style. We mentioned that earlier. So you're going to see things like Genesis 1, God created the universe in 6 days, goes over the 6 days, and then Genesis 2, they're talking about the sixth day when God created Adam and Eve again. Also, the biblical evidence shows the Jewish faith was originally monotheistic, and the Jews later became idolaters. Okay? So, you know, you're going to have to really not just deny the miraculous, but just straight out call these authors liars. The biblical evidence shows the Jewish faith was originally monotheistic, and the Jews later became idolaters. They later became polytheistic. Also, study of ancient religions show that primitive peoples had technical sacrificial language. Let me repeat that. Study of ancient religions show that primitive peoples had technical sacrificial language. Now you might say, well, big deal. What does that mean? Well, what that means is, then why in the world do we got to look at the priestly code and say, well, because the sacrificial language in the priestly code was so technical, it couldn't have been written in 1450 B.C., therefore it must have been written about 400 or 500 B.C. Well, now we've dug down far enough and we found enough information, whether it's written on tablets of stone or whatever, we found enough information to show that ancient religions and primitive peoples had technical sacrificial language at that time. There were some people who believed that Moses couldn't have written his stuff in 1450 B.C. because humans couldn't write at that point. But now we found that writing existed during Moses' time, 1500 B.C. in the Roshana literature. Extensive writing, and it had to be around for years for that. In fact, now we've even found some writing that dates back to about 3000 B.C. I believe that was in Egypt. And my view of why man began to write was not because he got smarter, was because his memory was getting worse and worse as time went on. Because God created us perfect, and we went downhill after the fall on, and it got to the point where we couldn't memorize everything we hear anymore. And so we started becoming forgetful, and finally I said, forget this, man. I'm going to make little symbols and put them down on this tablet of stone, and that's going to remind me so I don't forget. This is some important stuff here. Oh. And that's it. You see the attention. What's that? Attention? Okay, everybody's got that when it comes test time. Okay, archaeological finds also have confirmed many portions of the Pentateuch. For instance, the city of Ur, they dug where the Bible said Ur was, they dug, and lo and behold, they found this advanced city of Ur that was an advanced city at the time of Abraham, when they said there were no advanced cities at that time. Shechem and Bethel, they found them. Archaeological finds have found them. The Hittite legal code. They used to deny that there was such a thing as the Hittites. Right? The turn of the century, that was one of the big things. So you believe the Bible. The Bible's filled with fairy tales. It made up a whole empire of Hittite peoples, and they'd laugh and have a good time about it. Well, now we not only found out about the Hittites, but we found their whole legal code. And Hittites go back to the time of Abraham. So we're going way before, 400 years before Moses now. Code of Hammurabi. The Code of Hammurabi. Common spelling. It's actually just Code of Hammurabi, just H-A-M-M.
U-R-A-B-M.
What is that? Yeah, the Code of Hammurabi, H-A-M-M-U-R-A-B-I, dates back to 1800 B.C. And it's similar to the Mosaic Laws. It's a legal code and similar to the Mosaic Laws. So they were saying, you can't have laws that advanced for these primitive peoples around the time of Moses. I mean, these people are, I'll make it over, exaggerate a little bit what they're saying. Is these people just came out of caves. I mean, they can't be having these sophisticated legal codes at that point. Even if they couldn't, remember, the law came from God, so God can be as sophisticated as he wants. But the fact is, we found men with sophisticated legal codes that date back to 1800 B.C. The Book of Numbers... Book of Numbers has two counting of the Jews. They count the Jews when they're supposed to go into the promised land, then the Jews, for the lack of faith, don't go in. That generation dies out in the wilderness, and then in the next generation, there's a recounting of the Jews. But the census list, the way the lists are given there, is similar to the 1800 B.C. Mary text. By the way, all these similarities that we're finding that date back either to Moses' time or 300 years before, you don't find that in the time frame of when these liberal guys say that these that their imaginary authors supposedly wrote. 1800 B.C. Mary text. M-A-R-I. Again, it's just a group of people. Their census lists were very similar to Numbers. Also, Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Bible, has the same format as the Hittite Suzerainty Treaty. The Hittite Suzerainty Treaty. What that means is a treaty between a king and his people. Okay? If you do this, I'll bless you. If you do that, I'll curse you. Deuteronomy is written in the same format. Now, I don't have time to go into it, but when you look at the format and then you read Deuteronomy, I mean, you can even get a good outline for the book of Deuteronomy. Hittite Suzerainty Treaty. That was the latter half of the second millennium, so you're talking maybe 1700 B.C. Also, that we have found ancient legends of creation and the worldwide flood throughout the world. Ancient legends of creation and the worldwide flood throughout the world. It seems that these are perversions of the true biblical account. Ancient legends of creation and worldwide flood throughout the world are possible perversions of the true biblical account. For instance, the ark, the dimensions given of the ark would not only float, but the more you weigh it down, the harder it would be to capsize. The ratio is the exact ratios you would want to build a large barge. 475 feet long, 45 feet high, 75 feet wide. When you look at the Gilgamesh epic and the Babylonian writings, I'm not sure if it's from that or the Enuma Elish, but one of those is the creation account, the other is the Babylonian flood account, and the thing was the ark was built like built like a Coke bottle, you know, and obviously that's not going to do too good. And so all these ancient legends of creation, the worldwide flood, probably could be traced back to one authentic story, one authentic account, which would have been the biblical account. The other ones read really, I mean, you talk myths, I mean, that's where you get, you know, when you tell a story, you go from one ear to the next, and it goes all the way around, and it gets stretched, and it's, that's how you get myths and legends, where they would develop. And then also the Jews accepted the law as Mosaic, as being from Moses, during Josiah's reform in 621 B.C. Jews accepted the law as Mosaic during Josiah's reform in 621 B.C. It is hard to believe that any large portion had just been written. Okay. Josiah? J-O-S-I-A-H.
In what B.C.?
621 B.C. Okay, that's the first five books of the Bible. Some strong arguments for the Mosaic authorship, and they're much stronger arguments than any supposed evidence that can be brought forward that Moses didn't write it. I'd like to mention Joshua. Joshua and the Conquest of the Promised Land. Joshua is the sixth book of the Bible. And The Amarna tablets, which date between 1400 and 1350 BC, on those tablets are reports from kings in the Palestine area, which would have been Canaan at the time. They were reports from kings in the Palestine area to Egypt, to the Egyptian pharaoh, requesting assistance from the Hapuru invaders. Now, let me write some of this stuff down here. Now, the book of Joshua, okay, it occurred right after Moses. Moses got done writing about 1410 B.C. Then Joshua took over when Moses died. So you've got right around this time, this 1400 to 1350 B.C. is when they date these tablets, the Amarna tablets. So that's right in the time frame. You know, they got to give a little on their dating methods and all. Of Joshua and the conquest of the promised land. What's that? Joshua, yeah. The book of Joshua, when they went to conquer the promised land. But in these accounts, there's reports from the kings in Palestine area to Egypt requesting assistance from the Hapuru invaders. The thing is, the word Hapuru, H-A-P-I-R-U, also sometimes is spelled Habaru, and many scholars believe we got our word Hebrew from it. Okay, now the thing is, when you look at this and you compare it with the book of Joshua, sometimes it says that Joshua leveled the Jews leveled the city, and lo and behold, the Amarna tablets will say that city was leveled. Okay, not every city is mentioned that with a Joshua defeated, but when they mention the same city, they mention it was either totally devastated, or if the Jews failed to totally devastate it, that's mentioned. Okay? However, there are also some cities that the Hapuru invaders defeated that Joshua says they didn't defeat. So some say, well, this we can't count this as evidence for it. All we have to realize is, who did the Bible say was a Hebrew? Anybody tell me? Okay, Abraham. Abraham was a Hebrew. And from Abraham came the nation of Israel. So they are Hebrews. However, if Abraham was a Hebrew, he couldn't have been the only one. He wasn't the only Hebrew. He was a Hebrew. He means he was one of many Hebrews. That means that there were other Hebrews. In other words, these nomadic peoples that were coming into the Palestine area and killing a good portion of the Hapuru, a good portion of the Hebrews were Israelites. But you also had some other nomadic Hebrews who are not Israelites. Okay, you see what I'm getting at?
So some of these cities that were destroyed by the Hapuru were not the Abram Hapuru.
They were not. Well, and some of them could have been.
But they weren't the Israelites.
They weren't the Israelites, but they could have been from Abraham, because Abraham had other kids that weren't part of the nation of Israel, because he's the father of many nations. That's a good point, too. So now you got the other Hebrews out here, but you got other Hebrews under Abraham as well. But there's tremendous accounts that coincide with Joshua and the conquest of the Promised Land. So now you have the sixth book of the Bible. You have the first five being pretty reliable. Now you got the sixth being pretty reliable. Then Isaiah. Let's take a look at Isaiah. The view, the most common view, now they got to change this view again. If these guys have all the answers, liberal scholars, why do they change their views every 10 years? They've gone from a deutero Isaiah to Isaiahs to now, I don't know if they call it tritio Isaiah or whatever. I don't know what they mean. There's three Isaiahs now, but the deutero Isaiah view, which holds that Isaiah 1 to 39 was written by one author, and Isaiah 40 to 60 was written by another author. Okay? Now, why did they do that? Why do they have to hold of you like that? Well, they're trying to explain away fulfilled prophecies. Okay? If Isaiah is predicting something's going to happen, they're going to say, well, he really wasn't predicting it. It happened before and he was writing later. So there's two Isaiahs, one who wrote before and one who wrote later. Okay? So now this break is not like the break in the first five books where the different authors, everything was edited and put together. This is a clean break. First 39 chapters written by this author. Last 27 chapters written by this other author. Okay? Reputation of this is that the author is familiar with Palestine, not Babylon. Now he's writing before the Babylonian invasion, about 150 years before it, writing in about 700 to 740 BC, somewhere in that time frame. It wasn't until 605 BC and 586 BC that the Babylonians came and took over. He's familiar with Palestine, not Babylon. If the second author really did write later, he would have been writing from Babylon, okay, which is what they claim. They claim all these predictions and all, he was writing because he knew Babylon. He was in Babylon already, and it was after they had been taken over. So when he predicts that the Babylonians would take them over, they're trying to say he had to be after that time and with him in Babylon. Secondly, there are predictions of the Medo-Persian overthrow of Babylon in the first section. So now, the Medo-Persian overthrow of Babylon occurred in 538 B.C., the first section, they admit, was written before the Babylonians took over Israel. And so you got a problem there. How in the world, if you're going to try to eliminate prophecy, predictive prophecy, there's no way you can put the first part of Isaiah, the first 39 chapters, after 538 B.C., and yet he predicts the Medo-Persian overthrow of the Babylonian Empire in Isaiah 13, verses 17 to 19. Also, there's a similar style in both halves of Isaiah. It sounds like it was written by one guy. Now, let me give you a quote from Jesus, John chapter 12, verses 37 to 41. But though he had performed so many signs before them, yet they were not believing in him, that the word of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spoke, Lord, who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Okay? So, Jesus is talking right now, and he quotes from Isaiah 53. And he said that Isaiah the prophet spoke these words. Verse 39. For this cause they could not believe, for Isaiah said, he has blinded their eyes, and he hardened their heart, lest they see with their eyes and perceive with their heart, and be converted, and I heal them. These things Isaiah said because he saw his glory and he spoke of him. Now what's the problem here? The problem here is that second portion that Jesus quotes from Isaiah is from Isaiah chapter 6. So Jesus quoted Isaiah 53, which is in here, and said Isaiah said that. And then he quoted Isaiah 6 and said Isaiah said that. Now, I don't know. Maybe you might want to side with the liberal scholars. I'm going to side, but it's for me and my house, we're going to side with Jesus.
What was the passage?
John chapter 12, verses 37 to 41. And then we got time for just one more. The book of Daniel. Oh, this is funny. This is hilarious. The book of Daniel, I can't imagine anybody being dumb enough to hold this view still. Anyway, the book of Daniel, they used to say it was written about 165 B.C. I mean, you got the Septuagint being translated at that time. I mean, that is crazy. Now, they said that it was written about 165 B.C. to encourage resistance to Antiochus Epiphanes, who was one of the Greek rulers at that time. But the real reason why is the critics refused to accept predictive prophecy, and so they attempt to date Daniel after the events already occurred. Okay, they attempt to date Daniel after the events already occurred. Now, the conservative view is that Daniel was completed by about 530 B.C. The reason why I say completed, Daniel lived under both the Babylonian and the Medo-Persian empires. So, you know, he might have written this stuff down like maybe from, I don't know, 570 to... He could have been, you know, he was taken captive. So he, as a young man, and he mentions he was a young man when he was taken, but from 586, he might have started writing immediately from 586 to 530 B.C. So the conservative view is the book is completed by 530 B.C. and that Daniel lived during both the Babylonian and Medo-Persian rule over Judah. Remember, the Babylonians took the Jews, the first invasion was 605 B.C., 586 B.C. they took captives from Judah. And then about 538 B.C. was when the Medo-Persian Empire knocked off the Babylonian Empire. Well, what does the evidence say? Now we've got two diametrical views. What does the evidence say? Archaeological confirmation, there's been much archaeological confirmation of historical characters in the book of Daniel that have been rejected, such as King Belshazzar. We've now found that was, they said, no, there was no such guy under that name and this and that. Now on cuneiform tablets, they have found Belshazzar, his name listed there. Darius the Mede, apparently Darius, or Darius, turned out to be a guy named Gubaru, and Darius was a title like Caesar. In fact, they think that the words are related. Caesar, Kaiser is related to Caesar, and Caesar apparently was related to Darius. In other words, it was a name like king. So Darius the Mede was just the king who was the Mede. He wasn't a Persian, he was a Mede. And so a lot of these guys, characters that they were saying they didn't exist, now we're finding out, we're digging a little further and finding out they did exist. Also, there's three Greek words in Daniel. So they said, well, it must have been written after the Greeks took over the Medo-Persian Empire. So they had to say it had to be at least after 300 B.C. or 330 B.C. when the Greeks took over. Problem with that. The only Greek word, three Greek words in Daniel, are all musical instruments. Okay? Now, the Greeks didn't take over Palestine until 330 B.C., but there was a lot of trade going on between Greeks and others, and the words would have come about. I've never been to Italy, but I say the word piano and cello. Daniel used three Greek words for instruments, and they were probably instruments that were invented in Greece anyway. So there's no problem with that. Also, Daniel uses early Aramaic. Aramaic was the Hebrew of Christ's time, but the Aramaic that he uses is much earlier Aramaic than the Hebrew Aramaic that Christ used. So he uses early Aramaic. And Daniel's theology supposedly proves a late date because he had a very advanced view of angels, the resurrection, and the kingdom of God. Not so, though. You can find any one of these doctrines in other writings, advanced views, doctrines about angels, resurrection, or the kingdom of God in other Old Testament books, which definitely predate Daniel. The major problem with this is that some of Daniel's predictions were fulfilled after 165 B.C. So if you don't believe in predictive prophecy, you're going to have to date Daniel so late that for all practical purposes, at least until the end time. I read a few other prophecies get fulfilled in the end times, and you'd probably have to date Daniel after 1996 or something. But some of Daniel's predictions were fulfilled after 165. For instance, his prediction of the four kingdoms. He predicted the first kingdom, which was Babylon. So he was talking about them. You are the king. You are the head of gold. He said to Nebuchadnezzar, 586 B.C., they took Judah captive. But he predicted the Medes and the Persians would come. And then they did, even before Daniel finished his book, 538 B.C. But then he predicted that the Greeks would take over. That occurred in 330 B.C., and that there would be a four-way split, and there was. But these scholars would say, well, that's why he had to write it after 165 B.C. But then he predicts another fierce empire would come in and would knock off the Greek Empire, and this happened in 63 B.C. So maybe we just want to put him after 63. Well, the Septuagint's been completed. I mean, to put him after 63 B.C. would be crazy. But that's when the Roman Empire came in. Now, he said the Roman Empire, it ended up breaking down into the legs of the statue. And so you have a separation into two parts. We saw that with the east and the west of the Holy Roman Empire splitting. And the final result will be 10 toes, 10 nations, 10 kings, and 10 kingdoms. But Rome took over. There's a prediction that was fulfilled in 63 B.C. But there's also messianic prophecies in Daniel chapter, by the way, the prediction of four kingdoms is in Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. But in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 27, you have the Daniel's prediction that the Messiah will be executed. That occurred between 30 and 33 A.D. And then he predicted that the temple would be destroyed after the Messiah is executed. That occurred in 70 A.D. So, if we really want to put Daniel after all his predictions are being fulfilled, that would be ludicrous. Because we've got copies older than supposedly the original would have been when the original would have been written. There you go, time travel. That's probably the next stage in liberal scholarship. Conclusion. The evidence supports a 530 B.C. date of Daniel for the completion of his book. Even the 165 B.C. date would have to admit major fulfillments of prophecies, and therefore, if predictive prophecy was the reason why they pushed the date forward, and we still need predictive prophecy, then there's no reason to push the date forward at all. There's no reason to doubt the 530 B.C. date. Okay, from here on, the lectures get easier, because that was our basic introduction. Those are the toughest arguments that the liberals offer. So we're not going to get into any more introductory matters. Now we're just going to basically just go over our survey. We're going to start with Genesis in the next lecture.